This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given.
Well, my name is John T. Hulbert III, not to be confused with the second or junior, obviously.
John is a dad and a coach. First, it was soccer and baseball. A while back, John and his family moved to Florida. That's when John's son decided he wanted to play lacrosse.
And next thing you know, I became a lacrosse parent.
Every time he played, John's son would put on gloves, elbow and arm pads, shoulder pads, and a helmet. But when John's daughter started playing the game, something was different.
They only wore goggles. That's all they wore, goggles and a stick and cleats, and that's all they were required to have.
Did that concern you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Boys lacrosse is a contact sport. In the girls' game, stick-to-stick contact is the only contact that's allowed. But John grew up playing ice hockey. He knows that sometimes things happen.
I've always had a helmet and full face mask. And some of the worst times I've ever been hit is always by accident.
John is now the head girls lacrosse coach at Estero High School in Southwest Florida. Last year, for the first time, high school girls in Florida were required to wear specially designed girls lacrosse headgear. It was a move that John welcomed.
The ladies are getting bigger, faster, and stronger. The game is getting better. It's developing. They're shooting balls, anywhere from 35 to 55 miles an hour. The way the play is going, you know, I want my players, I want my daughter to be as protected as she can.
But John Hulbert knows that this question of helmets in women's lacrosse, it's anything but simple. The controversy surrounding the issue runs deep.
Yes, it's like the Hatfields and the McCoys.
It might not make a lot of sense at first. What could be wrong with helmets? After all, the more we learn about concussions and the long-term effects of brain injury, the more reasons we have to worry. But here's the thing. Those who are arguing against the use of helmets are doing so because they also want to keep the players safe. And they know about the studies that show that wearing more protective equipment in sports leads to a higher level of aggressive play.
And we know from science that helmets will not prevent concussions.
That's Nancy Burke. She's a retired athletic trainer who specializes in injury avoidance. And this claim she's making, that helmets don't prevent concussions, a lot of other doctors and experts have told me the same thing. Nancy compares the brain to the yolk of a raw egg inside the shell. Shake the egg and the shell remains intact, but you can feel the yolk banging against the inside of the shell.
No helmet is going to stop that. It just isn't.
All of this has left people like Rosemarie Marinais wondering who and what to believe. Rosemarie is a teacher and a high school girls lacrosse coach in New Hampshire.
I really like the game the way it is. But if I'm going to be a responsible coach, I have to know what's true instead of just go with my biases.
Last season, one of the towns in Rosemarie's division required all of its players to wear the new specially designed women's lacrosse headgear. U.S. lacrosse avoids using the word helmet for reasons that will become clear later.
I've had teams where one or two girls will wear headgear because their parents wanted them to, but we've never faced a team where the entire team was wearing headgear.
Rosemarie didn't want to name the team because she says they didn't do anything wrong. There was no unsportsmanlike behavior, no unusual aggression. But Rosemarie missed a lot of what was happening on the field in that game because she was busy attending to the only major injury her players suffered all season, a broken elbow.
The girls were the ones sensing that physically the other players were just too close and just felt just a little too safe coming close with their sticks, with their bodies, and that it just changed the nature of their space on the field.
And this is the big fear when adding head protection to girls' lacrosse, or any sport, really. Will adding more protection make players feel like they're more protected? Will they take more risks? Will there be more injuries? Rosemarie Marinais is looking for proof, some sort of scientific data comparing girls in Florida who are required to wear the new headgear to girls everywhere else who are not.
Headgear didn't seem to prevent boys from getting concussions, so what's the result with girls? if I'm going to be a responsible coach, I definitely want the answer to that question.
All right. Well, we'll see what we can do about getting you an answer.
That'd be great.
I'm just going to be upfront about this. I've spent almost a year looking into this story, and I don't have an answer to that question yet. But I can answer some other questions, like what happened to make so many women's lacrosse coaches so skeptical about protective headgear, and why might what's happening today be different from what happened then? Before we get to that story, we need to establish one thing, and that's that boys and girls do not play the same game.
There is nothing similar except for the lacrosse ball and the name.
This is Kathy Tomasetti. She officiates in Western Massachusetts and was the longtime girls lacrosse coach at Longmeadow High School.
There's not one rule the same. The field is different. The number of players on the field is different. There's just no similarities. They have the same name. And that's all I can tell you.
How did we get here? Two sports, one name? Well, lacrosse was originally a Native American sport played by men. It was sometimes called the little brother of war.
And the story is that Queen Victoria, at some point when she was visiting Canada, saw this game and thought it was a marvelous game and introduced it to women in England.
That's Susan Ford. She's a longtime coach and official and the president of the U.S. Women's Lacrosse Association from 1995 to 1997. Women's lacrosse developed into a free-flowing game of keep-away with very few rules and no strict boundaries. By the time coaches from England brought the sport back to North America, the emphasis was on fast breaks, skilled passing and catching, and
staying reasonably within the definition of what we would call now field space.
If the game's played in that spirit, Susan says, players don't come into contact with each other, and they shouldn't come into contact with the ball or sticks either. And there's something deeper going on here, because women like Susan aren't just committed to keeping the players safe. They also want to protect and preserve the unique nature of the women's game.
This is a game that belongs to us. We've nurtured it. We've taken responsibility for it. And we want to keep it this way.
But back in the 1980s, something happened in Massachusetts that threatened all of that.
So the court case, as I remember it, it was brought by a family whose daughter had been hit in the eye with a ball.
To avoid a lawsuit, the Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association, or MIAA, held a meeting and decided that high school girls would be required to wear helmets.
It was a gut punch. You know, it really was. To take responsibility away from the people who knew the game best and give it to people who had no idea of the history, of the context of the game, was just palpably unfair. And I think all of us left that room really dejected.
To make matters worse, lacrosse helmets that would fit high school girls weren't available. So the MIAA decided the girls would wear youth ice hockey helmets.
You put a helmet like that on a young girl, and when she turns to the right or the left, she sees the side of the helmet.
A lot of them didn't fit properly because they didn't buy new ones, they just used what they currently had.
That's former Longmeadow coach Kathy Tomasetti again.
The recklessness happened right away. I mean, it was just, everybody just thought she was protected, so they just swung crazily. And there were plenty of head checks that weren't even called because it didn't hurt them, is what the officials were saying.
I think things just got sloppier.
After a few years, Kathy took a break from coaching. And when she came back, she had a mission.
My goal was to get the helmets off the heads. It was so bad.
In 1995, almost a decade after the MIAA put girls lacrosse players in helmets, Kathy sent a survey to each of the 16 public high school girls lacrosse coaches in the state, asking if they were for or against helmets in girls lacrosse.
Actually, I sent him a little postcard in the mail inside a number 10 envelope. It was the old-fashioned way.
And they said, take them off. It was a unanimous reply from every single one of them.
But it was going to take more than a postcard survey to convince the MIAA. That's where athletic trainer Nancy Burke comes back into the story. At the time, she was heading up the safety committee for U.S. women's lacrosse, and she'd been asked to study the injuries that were happening in the sport.
Quickly, it became apparent that the injuries were not to the head as much as the injuries were to the nose and to the orbital bone, and in some cases, a fracture to small, very thin bones that support the eyeball. And these are serious injuries. There's no question about it.
Nancy believed that what the sport really needed was eyewear, but there was nothing appropriate on the market. And then one day, Nancy was having lunch with a representative from an equipment manufacturer.
I drew something out on a napkin, which was a version of a very shortened catcher's mask, and asked, "Do you think you could do this?"
A while later, Nancy had a working model, but it wasn't easy convincing college coaches to test it out. She showed up at an annual coaches conference with a slideshow of graphic photos of the injuries the girls were suffering, injuries she believed the eyewear would protect against. By the time she was done, 10 college coaches agreed to participate in the trials. 5 teams wore the eyewear, 5 teams did not, and the results were promising.
Orbital injury, head and face, nasal injury dropped to just about nothing with protective eyewear.
But even more important was what those coaches told their colleagues at the next annual conference.
They stood up and said this did not change the game. That was huge.
It was during this time that Nancy Burke got a call from Kathy Tomasetti asking for help. Nancy flew to Massachusetts to show the MIAA the data she had collected. She was nervous, but she didn't need to be.
They wanted to do the best by their student athletes.
The board had heard that helmets were changing the game, that college coaches weren't recruiting girls from Massachusetts because they didn't want to have to break them of bad habits. So when Nancy presented them with evidence that eyewear was a better solution, the board listened. Nancy Burke flew back to D.C. Later that night, she got a call from Kathy Tomasetti. The MIAA had voted to remove the mandatory helmet rule. Instead, girls would be required to wear eyewear.
How excited was Kathy when she called you?
Beyond the moon. She was over moon, and the other coaches were too.
Everybody was looking around and saying, well, let's not ever let that happen again. You know, let's be sure that any equipment that's introduced meets a certain standard to protect the integrity of the game.
Over time, what had happened in Massachusetts became a cautionary tale, and the myth surrounding it kept growing and kept giving lacrosse coaches another reason to resist equipment changes in the sport. In 1998, the governing bodies for the men's and women's games merged, coming under the umbrella of U.S. lacrosse. And about a decade later, when concussions started to become part of the national conversation, Ann Kit Carpinetti at U.S. lacrosse took another look at the data, comparing the injury rates of lacrosse to other sports.
And so the studies were showing us that, you know, our rates of concussion were, you know, fourth or fifth for women. We weren't the number one, but we weren't number 10 either.
No matter how many changes U.S. lacrosse made to the rules and to training for coaches and officials to make the game safer, there were always those who would drive past a lacrosse field and say, helmets are good enough for the boys' game. Why aren't girls wearing them, too? But still, whenever the organization floated the idea of headgear, there was a large contingent of coaches, especially in college, who would remember what happened in Massachusetts and say, not again.
For me, it was like the enigma. Like, I kept hearing about what happened in 1986. What I'd heard was, oh, it just got so violent. They just decided it was safer for the players to take them off. I'm like, I need to see what this looks like. I actually got a copy of a video.
Oh, it was a nice cut by Wellesley there. Lucky that wasn't a pass.
I didn't see any of that kind of physicality that in my mind I was expecting to see, like girls just swinging at each other's heads. But that wasn't it at all.
Anne sent me the video. I also don't see girls swinging wildly at each other's heads, but I do see a game that looks slower, less skilled, and yes, sloppier than the game that's played today. In 2010, U.S. lacrosse decided that it was time to develop a standard for head protection that would mitigate stick and ball impacts in the women's game. No, it would not stop concussions, but maybe it would help? The organization knew that this time they needed to get it right. So they made sure that everyone had a seat at the table, from researchers who knew the latest injury data to people like Susan Ford, who had fought against the use of ice hockey helmets in Massachusetts.
I went to those meetings. I listened to the manufacturers. I listened to the doctors. They were very, very clear on what the women's game was all about and why we wanted to do the best for the players on the field. And the standard took a while to get to where everybody felt comfortable with it.
The headgear, U.S. lacrosse is still careful not to call it a helmet, came on the market in spring of 2017. And I have to say, it looks a lot like a helmet to me. For most players, wearing the headgear is still optional. And while the design worked well in the lab, U.S. lacrosse is currently funding a study to address the bigger questions. Does the headgear reduce concussions? Are players more likely to suffer other injuries because they're taking more risks? And does the headgear change the character of the game? Those answers aren't ready yet. But Ann Kit Carpinetti says she hopes to have some data to share by August. When LA Times columnist Bill Plaschke was 13, his mother typed up his cliché-ridden sports stories.
She would occasionally stop typing, glance up at me, and smile.
Looking good, Billy.
Our radio reimagining of Plaschke's Mother's Day tribute is coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef. Traceability so bold that customers can even know the genetic pedigree of their steak or burger. From a six-generation family ranch in the Nebraska Sandhills, Honest Beef is dedicated to telling the story of your beef. Follow along on Instagram to see their life on the ranch, working to provide their customers with high-quality, dry-aged beef that they can feel great about. From their ranch to your door, they'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
The fact that in 2019, we're having this debate about measles vaccine makes my head want to explode.
We're just in this strange, really strange place, and the only people speaking up are the parents.
Endless Thread, the podcast from WBUR, Boston's NPR station, and Reddit, brings you a special series on the history of vaccines and anti-vaxxers.
Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
I always say, you know, for me, negativity is nothing. So as long as it doesn't kill me, it makes me stronger, like I said. So
that was South African runner Caster Semenya speaking to BBC Sports after winning a race in Doha last Friday, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach via Skype and by Bleacher Report's Mirren Fader. Welcome back to both of you.
An honor as always.
Hey, Karen, thanks for having me.
All right, Mirren, you're first.
At the beginning of the month, the Court of Arbitration in Sport decided to uphold a ruling that requires athletes with what they call disorders of sex development, more commonly called intersex conditions, to lower their testosterone levels if they want to compete with women. They said, you're free to compete with men, but if you want to compete with women, you are going to have to undergo medical regulations. You know, you could have to do invasive surgery if it comes to that. They basically are saying, you know, you aren't woman enough and you are too dominant. Because this is really focused on athletes that do races that she does, which is kind of the middle distance, the 400 meters to a mile. I really think that this is going to have devastating effects on inclusivity within women's track and field. It really is truly a discriminatory ruling against athletes like Caster Semenya.
I have to say, this is absolutely just flabbergasting. I mean, she's a woman. I mean, it's so bizarre. And basically reverse doping, right? They're asking her to, like, if she wants to be with a woman, she has to lower her testosterone and to take, like, hormonal contraceptives, which, by the way, are not like Flintstones vitamins. Like, these things have side effects. Eleanor Fulton, a pro runner, she wrote, "Listen, it feels to me like a humanity fail. I don't feel like we as humans will look back on this issue and feel like we were on the right side of history with mandated hormonal manipulation. I guarantee you, I am not a futurist, but there is no way that history looks back at this decision and doesn't find it shameful."
You know, I've been looking back this week to coverage from 2004. Maybe you know where I'm going to go with this. Michael Phelps had just set 7 world records in 41 days, and he was portrayed as a genetic freak. His torso was too long for his legs. His arms were too long for his height. He had size 14 feet. He had hyperflexibility and, quote, a freakish ability to recover quickly. And all of this was, like, sort of breathlessly reported as if Michael Phelps was built by some sort of higher power to swim very, very fast. But nobody was suggesting that the International Swimming Federation should make a rule that only affected athletes with the specific genetic differences that Michael Phelps had. That would just be completely unthinkable. But I have been trying to put myself in the shoes of the people whose livelihoods, whose ability to feed their families depends on running faster than Caster Semenya. Miren, as you said, Caster is believed to be intersex. We've had a similar conversation, you and I, in regards to a high school runner who is transgender. And you made the really good point that in high school, the stakes are low. There's no reason to pull her from the sport. Does that argument at all change when we're talking about elite professional runners?
I mean, I think it's a different argument considering, you know, the high school runner, the transgender runner. But I think the common thread throughout this is that there are so many things that can affect an athlete's performance, right? Mm-hmm. And if you single it down to just sex, you're missing all the other factors that are contributing. You know, Caster is an interesting case because if Caster was not dominating, I really don't think the conversation would be what it is now. I mean, it's clearly targeted at her races.
Will, you're up.
So last Friday, one of the more intriguing questions in the otherwise very boring world of sports media was answered in that 21 regional sports networks, your Fox Sports Midwest or your Fox Sports South and so on, were sold to avoid kind of antitrust issues. So there were a lot of bidders for this. Liberty Media, Major League Baseball, a group led by Ice Cube, which would have been awesome, by the way. But no, it turns out it was none of them. Instead, it was Sinclair, our friends at Sinclair Broadcasting, those, of course, who brought us that wonderful video famously put together by Deadspin's Tim Burke, where they bought all these regional news networks and had them do, like, very kind of disturbing right-wing propaganda. And so basically, they have moved into sports. And so there's a lot of people worried in the world of sports that, like, wow, if Sinclair, this right-wing group, buys these local stations, what's the programming going to be like? And I would argue it's bad because the programming's probably not going to change anyway. There are things that these networks already do that Sinclair doesn't even have to ask them to do. We like to think that the world of sports has become more progressive and become more inclusive, and in some ways it has, but on the whole, I think that Sinclair will find this a pretty friendly territory.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's not something that we aren't already seeing. I just think that, you know, it's gonna, I don't know, if there is any effect, it would be more so the person watching, like, do I want to watch this and support, which is hard because you want to watch your sports. But yeah, I don't think it's going to be anything different than what the networks are already doing.
You know, I did find myself wondering as I was thinking through this, what would have happened if Colin Kaepernick had kneeled and Sinclair had owned the network? Like, how would that affect how that was covered, what was shown? And so in that sense, I suppose I am worried. But I really think that, you know, anyone who gets their news from their play-by-play guy is already getting a skewed view of the world, right? So I'm actually not worried about the fact that the Sinclair Group now owns 21 regional sports networks. I am concerned about the fact that they own 193 news stations.
Yeah, and on one hand, I think that's true. On the other hand, certainly one of the things that Sinclair says is that, oh, don't worry, you won't even see politics on our broadcast at all, which is kind of the new thing now, right?
Like,
but that is really a very corporate way of saying stick to sports. I think what you'll see, frankly, is you won't see Kaepernick mentioned at all. Yeah. You won't see the kneeling mentioned at all because we're trying to stick to sports here. And as I always try to remind people every time I write anything about politics and sports, and they're all yelling at me to stick to sports all the time, it is impossible. Like, you cannot separate politics from sports because you cannot separate politics from anything.
Yeah. All right. Well, on Wednesday, Nick Saban, he of Alabama football's 6 national championships, was interviewed on WJOX in Birmingham. And he was asked about Game of Thrones.
No, I get it. But, you know, the White Walkers were the bad dudes, man. I mean, if we were recruiting, we would go north and try to recruit some of those guys.
All right. I'm probably the only person on the planet who has never watched an episode of this show. But I am told by very good sources that the White Walkers are not such a good choice. They're rather slow. Apparently, lateral movement might be a problem. What fictional character would you recruit to play on your team?
Karen, you are not the only human on the planet that does not watch this. I am coming in second, and I log onto Twitter, and I'm like, Sundays, I'm like, wow, what are you all talking about? But it's just hilarious when you're like, oh, okay, this is my beat, and I don't understand this reference.
So I would say, if I may continue to our unrepresentative sample size theater, I also have not watched Game of Thrones. It actually gives me a good sense of what it's like to for someone that literally never watches sports. Like, that must be what it looks like, right?
Right.
However, I will say, if you are going to be recruiting fictional characters, if I may speak to another recent online meme, how about Sonic the Hedgehog, right? Oh. If they fix his teeth, Sonic the Hedgehog is an incredible running back. There is no way he can go through you. He can go around you. He is a hedgehog after all. Sure, Sonic, there's an injury risk. But honestly, they're making hedgehogs by the dozen these days. So by all means, I'm going to go with Sonic.
All right, I'm going to fight you on this one, Will. Because I don't want to get all spoilery, but I'm going with Captain Marvel. If you have a precious object and want to get it past a ton of defenders, she is your gal.
Yes. So apparently she's always on other worlds playing other sports until she is needed specifically.
She might not be there for you when you need her.
I need consistency. Vote hedgehog.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Bleacher Report's Miran Fader and New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
She was my first reader, my first editor. Even my first publisher.
Those are the words of Bill Plaschke, a columnist with the LA Times.
Her weary fingers tapping out my first words in a darkened basement in the middle of the night.
For Mother's Day 2018, Plaschke wrote an appreciation of his mother, Mary Margaret Plaschke. This year, we're giving it a double play. That's what we call it when we turn a newspaper column into a radio drama.
I was a 13-year-old sports writer who couldn't type, so my mother would type my stories for me. It was always Sunday, always late. She had to report for work at the Ford plant early the next morning. But she would wait up for me to scribble my youth league baseball game story into a little blue binder. Then she would take the binder and walk down the steps to the rickety tray table that held the whirring Corona electric typewriter. Once there, my dreams, always her dreams, she began to peck away. She didn't love sports, she didn't understand everything I was writing, but she pursed her lips and hunched over the keyboard and diligently copied my cliche-ridden sentences as if recording the greatest story ever told. I would stand next to her the entire time, holding my breath, watching, waiting, hoping for even the smallest reaction. She knew it, so she would occasionally stop typing, glance up at me, and smile.
"Looking good, Billy,"
she would say. "You're almost done," I would say. But she was never done. When she finished typing, I would carefully place the pages into a large manila envelope. We would then walk upstairs and climb into a rattling Pinto, which she would drive through deserted streets across the east end of Louisville, Kentucky, eventually pulling up at the storefront that housed the neighborhood weekly newspaper. I would jump out and slide the envelope into the mail slot. I would return to the car to find her sitting at the wheel with her eyes closed. I used to think she was in deep thought. Now I know she was just tired. We would quietly return home, and she would disappear down the hallway for a few hours of sleep. 4 days later, my little story would miraculously appear on the pages of the Voice Jeffersonian. Except the miracle wasn't the newsprint. It was my mother, the strongest person I know. Maybe like a mother you know, one of those powerful women who never stopped carrying us. I talk to her every day. I'll call her cell. She rarely picks up. I'll leave an intentionally long and slow message. She'll call back in the middle of that message.
Found it!
She shouts triumphantly. She is still a mom. Age has softened her stature, but nothing could stop her from being that mom. She is still that feisty redhead who scolds me to work harder, nags me to be stronger, and listens to me forever.
No, you first,
she says when we both start speaking at the same time. Me first, always first. In a way, we are still working together. Only now she hunches over her laptop and pecks away at the Times website in search of my byline. When she fails, she asks me to email my column. I'll forget, and she'll ask again, and make some crack about
sometime this year.
And finally, I'll send her 5 stories at once, at which point I'll receive 5 texts from her, 1 per story, all of them with the same familiar tone.
Looking good, Billy.
Mothers are lifetime cheerleaders, true believers, the ultimate homers. Mothers are also reality checks, truth tellers, trash talkers, who always have the last word.
Is there something wrong with the Rams? Bill Plaschke? Yeah,
the best part about being a panelist for the long-running ESPN show Around the Horn is that it allows my mom to see me at least twice a week. She sets up in front of the TV with a glass of wine and calls it her happy hour.
After the game, Sean McVay said, oh, it's my fault. It's not.
Yet she has the same comment about every show, and it's never about my arguments. It's always about my clothing.
You have to wear a tie,
she insists.
Otherwise, everyone sees your fat neck.
She pushes me like she's always pushed herself. She grew up in a household of 9 in Louisville's depressed West End. Her father, Willie, worked on the railroad. Her parents never owned a house or a car. She shared a bed with 2 of her brothers. Her early life was filled with hardship, but you'll read no more of it here, because she's a proud woman who asked if her son could, for once, go easy on the melodrama.
Do not make this story sad,
my mother commanded.
This is not about poor me.
I'll be visiting her in Louisville this Mother's Day, and I hope I can be standing next to her when she reads this column. She didn't type it, but she wrote it. She's been selflessly writing it for my entire life. And this time, I'll be the one who glances down at her and smiles. This time, finally, it's my turn. Looking good, Mom.
That's our radio reimagining of Bill Plaschke's LA Times column from May 13th, 2018, read by Alex Ashlock and Karen Miller Medson. You can find a link to Plaschke's column and more double plays at onlyagame.org. And to all the mothers out there, including mine, happy Mother's Day. When former college soccer player Matt Eliason was invited to play an exhibition against Lionel Messi, he didn't think he was going to play much at all, but
more and more players drop out, and eventually you're doing the math, and you're like, they only have like 16 of these, you know, high-level pros. They got to fill in these starting spots with someone, and slowly, as it built towards the game, I was just kind of shocked at how it was working out and that there might actually be a chance for me to get on the field.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
We know sometimes you need a break from all of the negativity, but there are so many good things all around us. Kind World is a show about profound acts of kindness that help transform lives. New episodes every Tuesday. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, former Baltimore Raven John Urschel explains why he left the NFL to pursue a doctorate in mathematics at MIT. And here's a hint, it wasn't because of that concussion he suffered while with the Ravens. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
The St. Louis Blues have advanced to the Western Conference Finals, where they'll play the San Jose Sharks. The really fun thing about the Blues is the fact that on January 2nd of this year, they were the worst team in the NHL. Is it just me, or does January 2nd feel like it was about 2.5 weeks ago?
I'm sure for the Blues, it feels like it was 5 years ago. But it's a great story. And of course, the Sharks have their own problems in the postseason, too. So these are a couple of interesting stories.
Yeah, well, neither the Blues nor the Sharks has ever won it all. Who do you hope moves on and gets that chance?
I kind of like to see the Blues do it, actually. They've been around long enough to be old school.
Charlie, I want to talk about the Celtics. Just a couple of weeks ago.
Can we not?
Well, just a couple of weeks ago, people were speculating about all four Boston teams winning championships. They even called it a Boston Slam. Now the Celtics have flamed out. What happened?
Well, first of all, they ran into a better team.
The Bucks have been the best team in the NBA since at least St. Louis was the worst team in the NHL. let's put it that way. And, you know, the Celtics were a chemistry set gone wrong. They were the chemistry set you have that blows up in your parents' basement.
Well, speaking of chemistry, a lot of people think it's all Kyrie Irving's fault. That seems a bit too simple for me. What do you think?
I think it's a lot of it's Kyrie Irving's fault. He didn't turn out to be Kyrie Irving either in the regular season when it was touch and go, or in the playoffs when he was really supposed to be Kyrie Irving. I'm sort of with Marcus Smart. I think there's a lot more going on than that.
As it turns out, Jeopardy champion James Holzhauer's childhood dream wasn't to win more than $1 million on a TV quiz show. He wanted to work in Major League Baseball. And this week, the Washington Post asked MLB teams if they'd hire Holzhauer when his Jeopardy run is over. Are you surprised that they said yes?
No. I mean, first of all, it's a great public relations move. Second of all, the guy is clearly smart. My guess is he's probably, you know, studied baseball as closely as he studied potent potables. And third, the quickness on the buzzer can't be denied. I'd let him run my draft if I was the Cubs.
Holzhauer's current earnings stand at $1,691,008 over 22 consecutive wins. You might remember that Ken Jennings won $2.5 million and won 74 times. Will Holzhauer break one or maybe both of these records?
I think he might get the first one. I'm not entirely sure about the second one, but this is another good thing. You don't have to pay him. Maybe he'll work for free.
Charlie, your old friend Sepp Blatter is back in the news. For those who might have forgotten, Blatter is the former head of FIFA who is serving a 6-year ban for his part in soccer's corruption scandal. What does Blatter want from his former employer?
Damn it, he wants his watches back. He wants all his watches back. The dozens of luxury timepieces, as the New York Times put it. I don't know why. He should be doing time instead of worrying about keeping it. As far as I'm concerned, there's 120 of them, by the way, and each of them is worth somewhere between $5,000 and $20,000.
And finally, Charlie, this week we saw or heard what has been called by some the worst national anthem rendition of all time. And I'm going to play you a little just so you can be the judge.
By the dawn's early light, whose side? Let me hear you, people. Least the so bright beaming.
I think the best part of that is when he tries to get the crowd to bail him out, and the crowd sort of en masse goes, "Nah, dude, you're on your own."
Like it's their fault.
Yeah. You know, first of all, if you haven't seen it, I don't know why the guy decided to dress like a creamsicle. That's the first thing. Second of all, why is he wandering around singing?
Well, to be fair, he is an employee of the High Point Rockers, which is an independent league team in North Carolina, and he was a last-minute fill-in. He was not supposed to sing the anthem that day. But get this, the team says they'll actually invite him back after he gets singing lessons.
And a lyric sheet, I hope.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you. If you're subscribed to the Only a Game podcast, you've probably already noticed that we sent out some special content this week. It's an episode from our friends at the WNYC podcast Death, Sex, and Money, and it features writers Damon Young and Kiese Lehman. Damon and Kiese talk about death, sex, and money, and also basketball.
And also, like, real talk, it was just one of the only spaces where we could be outside and touching each other, you know, hugging each other, hitting each other on the butt, posting each other up, like feeling like press each other's like the bodily weight on one another.
We think you'll like it. Check it out by subscribing to the Only a Game podcast on Apple, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It had been nearly 2 years since Northwestern alum Matt Eliason played college soccer.
I was just sitting in my office, or I should say cubicle. It's not important enough for an office.
When he got a strange text from his old coach, Tim Linehan.
He's like, yeah, do you want to play with Messi? Yes or no?
It was 2013, and Lionel Messi, considered by many to be the best soccer player in the world, was hosting a charity game in Chicago.
I did an autocorrect with my brain trying to think about, you know, what does he mean by play with Messi? Are we going to show up to a practice and get his autograph?
Most athletes, even very good college athletes, never get the opportunity to play with their childhood heroes. But Matt Eliason was about to find out what that would be like. Here's Only a Game's Nico Emack.
In 2007, Matt Eliason was a high school senior. His future as a soccer player was uncertain.
So once the head coach of Northwestern, Tim Linehan, said he had a walk-on spot for me, I was really excited and was just anxious to get there to try and prove that I belonged as a Division I soccer player.
Matt made the team, and over the next 4 years, he scored 33 career goals, becoming Northwestern's all-time leading goal scorer. A few weeks after his senior season ended, Matt was sitting in a Chipotle when he received a call from Major League Soccer. He had been invited to the combine ahead of the 2011 draft.
In my head, I thought the call might come, but, you know, wasn't completely sure. And so then it kind of made me shift my focus to, okay, what am I going to do now?
Matt decided to take some time off from school and headed down to Fort Lauderdale for the combine. He was eager to show off his skills in the scrimmages.
I got through, had a couple assists, but ended up not scoring. And in my head, a bit of doubt creeped in. And I was just kind of like, oh, man, the one thing I'm really good at, scoring, I wasn't able to do in these three games.
Matt flew back to Chicago and resumed his classes. The draft was a few days later.
I was kind of just checking Twitter and checking online to see who took what. And I assumed if I wasn't getting any phone calls, that probably was not good news.
It wasn't. Matt went undrafted. He received an invitation to try out with Sporting Kansas City, but he broke his foot before preseason workouts. Matt hung up his cleats.
Ended up taking a role in corporate finance in Chicago. So once I took that, I kind of crushed the dream of ever playing in MLS.
Nearly 2 years passed. Matt settled into his new life. He didn't play much soccer. But luckily, on the day he got that text from Coach Linehan inviting him to play with Messi, he'd recently finished a half marathon.
I was actually in good shape, which, if they had asked a year earlier, might not have been the same answer.
Matt figured he'd ride the bench. But as he learned more details, he began to realize he might actually get a shot at playing.
And then more and more players drop out, and eventually you're doing the math, and you're like, they only have like 16 of these, you know, high-level pros. They got to fill in these starting spots with someone, And slowly, as it built towards the game, I was just kind of shocked at how it was working out and that there might actually be a chance for me to get on the field.
On July 6, 2013, Matt and his teammates waited anxiously in a hotel near Soldier Field, all the while rubbing elbows with players from some of the best teams in the world.
Famous stars like Alex Song, who at the time was on Barcelona, was just kind of hanging out there, and we're like, oh, hey, what's up? He's probably confused. Who are these random people talking to me?
The excitement of the game didn't really hit Matt until he boarded the team bus.
As we were driving over in the bus, you saw fans waiting outside of Soldier Field for Messi, not for us. But we're kind of going into the stadium and just seeing like thousands of fans surround the bus. It was a pretty cool sight, and it actually started to get a little nervous because in my head I didn't expect to do too much in the game, and then I was like, oh, if I actually get on the field, there's a lot of people here.
Inside the locker room, Matt was formally introduced to his new teammates, legendary players like Maluda and Thierry Henry. His team was coached by Fabio Capello, the former manager of the English national team.
One of the most high-profile coaches in the world, and he's sitting there giving our pregame speech, and it was just went to 100 real quick. I was like, oh my gosh, what did I get myself into here? The advice was pretty much just pass the ball to the pros. We were kind of there as place fillers, and they're like, don't try and do too much. Pass the ball to the good players.
The moment was so surreal that Matt didn't even realize he was in the starting lineup.
I just kind of trotted out there, warmed up. Carlos Bocanegra was like the center back. I grew up watching him at Fulham and on the U.S. men's national team.
Warm-ups ended, and Matt took his place with the starters. He gave himself a little pep talk beforehand.
I was kind of like, okay, let's just try and do, you know, be as simple as possible. Just try and pass to the closest person. Let's not make this too complex. But then about 10 minutes into the game, the competitive spirit takes over you. And, you know, players are playing hard. They don't want to be embarrassed, but it's not like it's not as fast as it would normally be in a real game. So I kind of saw some opportunity. I was like, if I actually get a chance to like go for it a little bit, I might be able to get a good shot off.
In the 27th minute, Thierry Henry received the ball at the top of the 18-yard box. Matt saw his chance. He made a darting run behind the defense and looked for a pass from Henry.
It was kind of too much behind me to try and head the ball, so it popped up onto my chest. And then I'm facing the wrong direction, so kind of just decided to go for it.
Like an acrobat, Matt jumped in the air, his whole body suspended in mid-flight, his legs flung upwards, striking the ball.
Eliasson! Oh! How about that? Matt Eliasson, the Northwestern grad. What a memento.
Matt had just scored a bicycle kick in a game against Messi.
Maluda and Thierry Henry came and like jumped on me, and I was like, wow, this is real. And then the rest of my teammates came and we're like, oh my God, I can't believe you actually just did that.
Messi's team won the game 9-6, but news of Matt's goal began to spread.
I actually went golfing the next day, and I remember one of my buddies who also played in the game, Cody Stanley, was like, dude, your video is up to 180,000 views on YouTube. And I was like, oh man, that's pretty crazy. That's a lot. And then we played 9 holes and then came out, and it was at 1.2 million views. I know the big thing for me coming into work was that they had an article on it on the back page of the Wall Street Journal, which holds more weight where I work than ESPN.
Matt's CEO even sent him an email
saying, man, that's so cool. You made it onto the Wall Street Journal, and it only took you like a few months of working here.
Matt's CEO wasn't the only one who noticed. Professional teams from around the world began reaching out, offering Matt chances to try out. One of those teams was the New York Red Bulls.
I played in a few reserve games, played pretty well. Again, kind of when I needed to, didn't score. And I think that was, you know, ultimately a forward's going to be evaluated on whether they score or not.
It didn't help Matt's chances that the New York Red Bulls already had forwards Thierry Henry, Tim Cahill, and MLS MVP Bradley Wright Phillips. But Matt's trial with the team did raise his profile.
That team, Throttur from Iceland, the coach emailed me and said, hey, you know, I saw the kick, heard you were with Red Bulls. We really need a forward. We'd love to have you in for a trial.
Matt scored in his trial game and was signed by Throttur FC in 2014. Finally, he'd have a chance to fulfill his dream of playing professional soccer.
Whenever I score, that's when the good things happen. So I try and do that more often.
That story came from Only a Game's Nico Emack. You can learn more about Matt and his time in Iceland in the new documentary Messi and Me, directed by Rennie Maslow. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.